Hey, I'm only calling for two things. Gateway's to Annihilation is the best Morgaine album out there, and Joe's Dog is a sexual deviant, and it fucking disgusts me. It's just disgusting.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Well, howdy, friends. It's your boy, Joe Thrash and Kill, here with another hot episode of the Toilet of Hell radio show. I'm joined today by my good buddy, 365 Days of Horror, and we've got a special guest. Please welcome, from Absolute Contempt Records, Daniel Zambrano. Daniel, how you doing?
Hey, man. Doing good. Kind of awake, so...
Yeah, I like to schedule these early because it puts everybody on their toes. Makes everybody... their absolute best self when they're groggy and hungover.
Definitely did that for me, yeah.
I may or may not have stayed out drinking Coors Lights until 1 a.m., but hey, I'm here. Jordan, did you do the same?
I am the only one who's fresh and ready, as usual, for the show. I'm like a Summer's Breeze or Summer's Eve commercial. I went to a show last night, actually, a hardcore show. I haven't been to one in a couple of years now. It was to see Sworn Enemy, who I love very much, and I try to see them whenever they come to town. The show had seven bands on the bill, but it started at 5 o'clock, and the venue had dance night or something afterwards. Like, it starts at 10:30. The show was done at 9:50. It was awesome.
Praise the Lord.
It's incredible. I think it's one of the first times that's ever happened to me, going to a show, and from now on I want all shows to do that.
You could have just said like seven bands were on it, and I would have been like, well, that sounds like a hardcore show.
Yeah, exactly. It was good. What hardcore does really well that metal could really take a lesson from is, you know, 25 minute set times, quick on and off, no 40 minute sound check, you know. You get your six songs and you're done. It was great.
I think that's one of the best things that hardcore has given to metal, because I'll go see some shows that are kind of, you know, on the borderline of what kind of audience it might be. And it's very much the same, like 25 minute sets, you're on and off as soon as possible. My problem is that generally the shows are starting at like 10, and that's just no brainer for me, man. Because, you know, I think we talk about it on every episode. We're old. We got places to be early in the morning, man. I can't be out late circle pitting until 2 a.m. Come on now.
Yeah, most of the shows I ever went to were at this one place in Miami, Churchill's Pub. And all the flyers that I have, and probably a lot that I don't, said something along the lines of, like, doors at 7, band. And at 8, and I was always the one guy who believed it and was there. Like, I was like, I got there around 8, and the last few years of that were pretty rough, because I have a flip phone, I don't have a smartphone, so, you know, I'm standing there pretending that I'm doing stuff on my flip phone, but there's nobody else at the bar but, like, the people who've been there all day and me.
You playing, like, Snake on there, or what are you doing?
Actually, you know what's fucked up? They took down the stores that sell the games for the flip phone. And I deleted Tetris off my phone, so I just have like one round of Tetris on my phone that I have to play over and over again.
Oh, man. That's
purgatory.
Yeah, it really is. I'm not trying to convince you to make the leap to a smartphone or nothing, but maybe buy a Game Boy if you're going to be out somewhere for a while.
I actually own one.
There you go.
Actually, two of them. I just never take them anywhere.
I'm pretty hip into the technology now. I got a Nintendo Switch, which I've never played off the dock anywhere, because it's like the size of a toaster. I don't know how, like, people can take that out in public.
Yeah, I think it says too much about you if you've made the decision to take that like out of the house. Like,
oh yeah,
this is really important to me right now more than anything outside of the house.
You're like a half step away from growing a ponytail and carrying a samurai sword on your back.
Pretty much.
Well, Jordan, did you were any of the other bands good?
So I actually ran into traffic, so I showed up a little bit later than I wanted to, but I definitely wasn't going to show up at 5 to watch all these bands, so
right.
I only caught one, and it was, I actually tweeted about this, it was like a breakdown chugging type band, but the vocalist was doing like Cookie Monster vocals, and they had a keyboardist, and I just didn't know what to make of it.
So it was amazing.
People were into it, I was just kind of confused.
What was that band? Winds of Plague?
Bleeding Through had keyboards too, and they were one of the first ones doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, they were kind of more metalcore, so had, I guess, a little bit of melody here and there, where this is just, you know, chug-a-da-chug, chug-a-da-chug. It's like, what am I watching?
Do you still have like the tinkly keyboard bits on top of that, or what were they using this keyboard for?
I couldn't even really hear the keyboard, and it wasn't just the keyboard. He also had a laptop with him, which, I do not know what the purpose was, unless he was just playing samples off it, which is, you do not need an entire laptop to do that.
I really hope in the credits for that band, he is described as DJ something or other.
DJ Tanner. That was...
Excellent. Yeah.
Nobody tells DJ Request what to play.
I was actually, when I was in a hardcore band, we played a show in, I want to say, Louisville at a YMCA, and there was only one opening band, and they had a guitar player.
What?
I couldn't hear him, but I haven't seen somebody go off that hard opening a show. I don't know, since or before that, probably either.
It was props, man. That's a power move.
Yeah, no, like he was like, it was kind of the thing where you were like, where he was clearly doing it for himself. Like he was just fucking going off and having the time of his life, and the crowd was incidental to that.
That's it's that saying, man. Keytar like nobody's watching.
that guy, God bless him wherever he may be. I'm pretty sure the band was Christian too.
Sure.
he's a hit pastor now, like with a soul patch.
Tinkling the keys for Christ.
Yeah. You know what rocks, guys? Jesus rocks.
Hell yeah. I want that guy to be my youth pastor. Daniel, let's talk about something that actually matters then. You've been running Absolute Contempt for a few years. When did you get started with it?
The end of 2015. It basically kind of just happened because I'd been in a band that broke up in 2014, and because everybody else in the band was younger than me and way more modern, we had 3 releases, but they were only on tape. And I'm old, like you guys. I have an affinity for CDs still. Also, I really wanted to get everything like mastered together and put on a discography CD because I love discography CDs. So basically, the label started so I could get that out. And like, when I was putting it together, getting it mastered, you know, getting everything pressed and stuff, just had to find a label name, and then I threw that up on Bandcamp. And then after that, there was just a few bands in Florida where I was living at the time that had releases that kind of weren't getting picked up or weren't finding an audience, I guess. So I just offered to kind of throw my own money away and do my first couple of releases were Florida bands, and then I think a Swedish band after that. And then kind of I made a point out of I didn't want to go into the label expecting to make the money back. So everything that I put out, whatever money came back in, what I was giving to animal rescues, and it kind of went from there. People, like, I mean, you'd be amazed once you put the word records in your Bandcamp profile, like, how many people will message you about putting out their stuff. So it's kind of been since then going through that.
So do you mostly get people that know what your sound is about, or do you get, like, SoundCloud rappers that try to hit you up too?
Pretty much mostly, because one of, you know, just kind of playing the Bandcamp game, you have to use the tags a lot. So yeah. I do wind up getting mostly people that are doing stuff that that falls somewhere in the spectrum of what I want to put out. I mean, you know, being from coming from the hardcore scene, grindcore, whatever. I'm not short on friends who want to put stuff out, or friends who know people who want to put stuff out. So just a healthy stream of stuff coming through, and pretty much having decided to, like, not be kind of financially dependent on the label to even be solvent, I get to put out whatever I want. So if I, you know, if some, it's happened. Like, I think the second release I did, which was this Swedish melodic death metal thing, was a one-man band that I bought his stuff before on Bandcamp, and he had no physical releases of his stuff, and I messaged him way before I even had the label, and I was like, if you ever want to put something out in the U.S., I'd totally be down to helping, because I really, really liked it. So when the label happened, he messaged me and he was like, you know, I see you're doing something. And that's the Hope Lorn CD that came out on the label. So it's that, you know, the having the focus be on that has also kind of kept, you know, SoundCloud rappers and ska bands from off my radar. Although, you know, if I listened to a good ska band, I would put it out.
Well, there you go. All of the ska bands listening to this episode, you know, if you've got the chops.
If anybody's doing a blackened prog ska band.
Fuck, we found a black metal ska band, like, not too long ago. What was that, Jordan?
Hold on, I'm going to look it up, but I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't think there's, like, a lot of them that Jordan would be like, which blackened ska band?
They're called Leper.
Leper, right?
And you can go on YouTube, and it's Leper, and the song is Wild and Free.
Wow. Yeah. I was definitely checking that out.
This stemmed from a conversation. We found a white power metal band. So we were trying to figure out what the dumbest combination of genres is. And sure enough, there's something out there for everybody, including black metal ska.
Even if the everybody's probably like the two or three people that desperately needed to hear that.
Yeah. So you mentioned, like, kind of running the label to your own financial detriment. I've always been curious about this because I've only ever put out one record through a label, and I know for a fact that the guy that put it out lost money on it because we sold so few of them. How exactly does the finances of putting out a record work for you as the label owner?
Well, for Absolute Contempt, just because it's, you know, one of the issues with the people who message me and stuff is that, like, people are kind of expecting a regular label type of approach, and mine is kind of everybody kind of gets the same deal. I pay to, like, press the stuff. I pay to promote the stuff a bit. I make sure the bands get actually more than they usually get, the share of the pressing and stuff. I don't cover other stuff. I haven't yet. But that's kind of been, I've been working. So for me, it's kind of like, I will take the initial hit of creating the physical item and getting it out into the world, and it creates a stream of money in me selling downloads and me selling the actual tapes and CDs that as soon as it comes in through Bandcamp for me, that just goes right back out to the different animal rescues that I work with. So for me, when I look at a release to do, basically look at X amount of money that is just going away. But pretty much, I think everything but like three things on the label have sold out. I have gotten some distros through a couple different distros. So if I was not giving away the money that was coming in, I think the label would be relatively successful in at least not being too deep in the red. But I think the way things are now, the way people listen to music, it is really, really hard to make your money back. And that's actually one of the things that's kept me from doing vinyl, because the initial financial hit of doing vinyl, of getting something pressed, is just so much more than I could sustain just losing outright, you know?
Yeah, I think people don't realize that vinyl is so expensive to make.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, also the one of the things with vinyl is that the number of records that you have, you know, they'll charge you less the more records you make. So if you're like I want to make a small run, so I'll just, you know, whatever, for a band that doesn't have like a huge, you know, public face or reach, so they can have the vinyl, blah, blah, they charge you more. So kind of the point where you're making enough copies to cover demand, but also enough to get like a good enough discount to where you're not paying ridiculous amounts per unit, it's too high. It's especially for smaller bands. So for now, I'm staying out of the vinyl game. I actually had a vinyl project that kind of fell apart just because of that. It was actually me and another label, and we just couldn't come to terms on how many we were gonna get made. Just in a way that we could both at least get some of that money back to a relatively successful conclusion.
Yeah, and you don't want to get stuck with hundreds of vinyls, you know, in a box exactly. Somewhere in your closet.
Exactly. Discogs is full of former label heads selling, you know, CDs for $1. And you don't want to do that with vinyl.
Yeah, I love seeing like the Hard Times article that was like it might not have been the Hard Times, it might have been the Onion, like man like keeps tripping over boxes of vinyl from his band from 10 years ago.
Yep. Yeah. Thankfully I'm not there yet with any of my releases. And I'm you know, trying to avoid it.
Well, so from what you're telling me is that starting an independent label is a dynamite way to financial independence.
Yes, I recommend it for everybody.
Which is pretty dope, man. You should do the Tony Robbins circuit. You know, speaking on how you can achieve a secondary stream of income or whatever it is those guys do. Walk over coals.
If you've got $200 and you want to make $190 of it back over 3 years, boy, have I got the option for you.
Well, so you would say then this is a passion project.
Oh, absolutely. It starts up when I want to start it up. It stops when I want it to stop. Like, it just comes out. Making it so it doesn't have to make money has made it a lot less stressful. Because I have a lot of friends that run labels. I'm actually, my friend Corey, who ran Halo Flies, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the label.
Yeah, I think that we've done a couple of things with Halo Flies, just like we've done a couple of things with Absolute Contempt.
Yeah, so like, for me, that was the level that I would have loved to been at as a label when he was kind of running it, and it just got too much. It got too the diminishing returns caught up to him, and like, that label is ending this summer.
That's a damn shame.
Yeah. So, you know, and it's it's happening a lot. Like, I think, was it 1349 Records closed up? Magic Bullet closed up this year. It's hard out there if you're trying to, like, you know, make it a sustainable business. So for me, like, even at the time where I wasn't in that, I was in a probably shittier place financially. Like, it was kind of the making a decision of, like, if I'm going to do this right to where I'm happy with what's coming out of the label, it can't depend on that.
Well, is there any kind of, like, I don't know, sustainable future for this kind of economy, or is it everybody just kind of has to put it out when they've got the time and money, unless you're, I don't know, Interscope?
No. Yeah, I think you can do it. I think there are labels that are doing it successfully, like making money and stuff. Unfortunately, I think, like, right, the ones that I'm seeing, the labels that I see that, like, you know, 20 bucks spin, somebody like that, the size that you have to do it at to where, like, the cash flow is enough is, I think, you know, a lot bigger than it used to be. And, you know, when you have an operation that big, it's not just like money. It's like, that involves a serious amount of time, a serious amount of work. So I think, like, in the future, you're going to see more, I hate using the term, but boutique labels like Absolute Contempt, where we're, you know, a CD tape label that does small runs. That's kind of the niche. And it's clearly aimed at people that want that, either cassettes or CDs of something that's probably available on vinyl, which is what sells the most these days. I think you're going to see more more tape labels, CDs are coming back, which is weird. I understand it because, like, they're so much easier to handle. But I think it's going to subsist as it always has. It changes, you know. Like, I remember coming up in the era of, like, the big distro, like, Lumberjack and Mortem and all these big distros that picked up smaller labels that were national and stuff, and all that stuff is gone now. So it evolved into, you know, it has gone through a couple little things, and it's coming out at an end where we have, like, a market for vinyl, a market for record stores. People like the experience, I think, of owning the physical item. I think a lot of vinyl sales are because of that. People want, like, the thing, you know, not just the download. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a market for it, and it will exist. It's just stuff that you were able to do before, you were not able to do anymore. But, you know, I'm an old man, so I don't know how, like, the newer labels are going to come in and handle it in a better way. Probably a lot more merch sales, pin sales, stuff like that, to help fund the music side of it.
That's an interesting thought, because it seems like, enamel pins, that's just a little thing that happened in the last couple of years that's blown the fuck up.
Yes, sir. Believe me, it's something I've looked into. It's, you know, it's a hustle. It's always been a hustle. Like, you know, I come from a punk rock world, and I've done it in the U.S. I did it for a brief little moment in Brazil. I did it for a long time in Colombia, where I'm from. And it's just different levels of hustle of, like, if you love it, if you want to do it badly enough, if God bless your girlfriend of many years lets you waste hundreds of dollars on it.
Like, God bless them. They put up with so much.
Yeah, the side eye when the record boxes come into the house and stuff, but, like, if you want it bad enough, if you're committed to it, like, I just want it to be, you know, I was not doing bands anymore when Absolute Contempt started. I saw the opportunity to help, you know, a guy I didn't know who made great music. And then, like, my I think my two releases after that where my friend Ryan Zell, who was in Cellgraft, which is like one of my favorite American grindcore bands of all time, his other bands, which I loved in Florida. And I was like, how is this? These releases don't have homes? That's ridiculous. And I just loved it and wanted it out, and I wanted to be part of it. So I think it's going to keep going. It's going to keep changing. It's just a matter of people wanting to make it happen.
Well, on the merch tip, on diversifying your portfolio, you know, cornering all areas of the market, I saw that Kiss, you know, those guys that occasionally merchandise an item or two, they make toilet seats right now, which for Toilet of Hell, like, I can't imagine a better fit for a product.
Yeah, where's our cut?
Yeah, but also I'm surprised they didn't get there before. I mean, you had Kiss condoms, you had Kiss wine, you had Kiss caskets, so you could be,
I know, like,
trapped.
Kiss caskets should have been the end game of that conversation.
You've been, you can spend eternity trapped inside of Gene Simmons's body, as Dimebag Darrell did. He chose to be buried in one of those things.
What?
Yep.
Yeah, man.
I did. Know that.
Yeah, those things were, you know, as it's the funeral industry is the biggest fucking grift around. Like, everything is overpriced, overcharged to the 10th degree. And so Kiss saw that and they're like, well, we can charge more if we put our stupid faces on it.
Wow. But that's amazing.
Given all the array of options that, you know, Kiss has trailblazed, what kind of merch would you like to see in your ideal scenario?
I don't know. If I came to a lot of money, soccer balls.
That'd be good.
Absolute Contempt soccer balls. I'd be into that. Absolute Contempt luchador masks.
Oh, hell yes. Yeah.
I'm going for that active market, people who at least watch sports of some sort.
See, I could totally see like a hardcore band doing their own luchador mask and having dudes go shirtless and wild in the pit wearing those. I think that'd be like a phenomenon.
I really think that's like an untapped market. I think if you had like 10 made and you like wore one on stage to on tour, you definitely sell 10 before the second or third date of that tour.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Soccer balls might be harder to move.
Perhaps. I don't know, unless you're touring like South America.
This would be I'm from there. I've been in soccer riots, so I know the power of the beautiful game.
Hold on.
you before we get into that, because we have questions. If you sell soccer balls at a show, you run the risk of people throwing the soccer balls during your set.
I mean, yeah.
Okay, as long as you're good with it.
I mean, like, you know, I think the longest tour I did was like a month, month and a half. And like, after you've done like five in a row where it just went well, you're kind of like, it'd be kind of cool if somebody threw a soccer ball up here or, you know, anything.
Hmm. Well, as long as you're not selling pretzels, you should be okay. So the soccer riot. Would you describe yourself as a hooligan?
No. I definitely knew people who would fall under that category, except the Latin American culture around it is a little different. Is more based around what they call barras, which is like organized groups of fans of a certain team, and they'll have names and they'll have specific chants, and they get super intense. The one there's actually, you know, the city where I'm from, Bogota, we have two teams, so the barras from one team absolutely hate the other. And the city, at least when I left the city like a decade ago, is covered in graffiti between the two. So like somebody will tag it CA13, which is one of the barras for one of the teams. And then the other ones, which were GARS, would come by and like tag over it. And this was all over the city. I was just somebody who really, really loved the team. I used to go a lot to the games and stuff. And a couple times I went up outside with, you know, dealing with water tanks and tear gas and whatnot.
So that makes me feel a little bit better, though, because like every time a city like Philadelphia wins a championship, there's just riots in the streets of dudes tearing down streetlights and eating piles of horse shit. So it's good.
No. it was more like a confrontational thing where like if. And there were certain rivalries, you know, within the city, that rivalry. And then there was like a couple other teams where like when that happened, the police would be out in force and they would, you know, the visiting teams fans would have to stay in the stadium for a little bit longer before they got out. Actually, that was kind of later on, earlier on. Everybody just got out at the same time and inevitably, like, you know, shit would get a little crazy and stuff. But it wasn't the like just random celebration. Celebrating in the streets, breaking shit. Although there was a little bit of that, but that's kind of reserved more for when the national team wins, and that just completely shuts down the whole country.
That's good. I'm glad that we can all find a cause to get behind to break shit for.
Yeah. So, how did you end up coming to the United States?
I lived here. I grew up in Colombia. Till like 95, and my parents got divorced. My dad got a job opportunity in Miami with the company he was with at the time, and after like a year, I moved up here with him. So I was living in Miami, and that's kind of when I got really into like the punk rock thing in Miami, going to shows there, meeting people there, people I'm actually still friends with and stuff. A couple years later, my dad moved to Brazil, so I wound up back in Colombia, and then I think I'd done like a year of college in Colombia, and I wound up moving up to the U.S. to finish college, I want to say in like 2002? Yeah, 2002, and I've been here ever since.
Right on. Sorry. When did you start the band Terrorist? That was the one that you put out the compilation for Absolute Concept,
yeah.
Right?
Terrorist started it actually started without me. It started as a three piece and that must have been 2011. And then they were looking for a vocalist and I hadn't done a band in a while. So I went and tried out and joined the band and kind of went from there. because they were doing more of like a Minscore thing when I joined, and the only vocals that I can really do well, or that I've convinced myself that I can do well, are kind of like black metal-y vocals. So I think that actually kind of changed the direction of the band a little bit. We went through a couple lineup changes, but I'm actually pretty proud of the music that came out of that. I was really happy in that band.
Hell yeah. I guess in the spirit of punk rock and soccer violence, Jordan was telling me that you had an encounter with the police recently.
I live in Arkansas.
Ooh, now. Apologies.
Northeastern Arkansas. Which
is there? Yeah. What's the nearest city to there?
I actually live like an hour and a half from Memphis in Tennessee.
Okay.
So I'm like right on the border. I did. It's something that like I've experienced a bunch since I've lived in this country. Like I actually, when I lived I lived all over South Florida over like, I don't know, the 12, 13 years or something that I was there. And when I lived in kind of the wider parts, places like Davie and Sunrise, which are Fort Lauderdale adjacent and pretty white, there was a lot of like me getting pulled over because I'm a Hispanic guy with tattoos in a white neighborhood. And then, you know, I've been straight edge for 24 years almost, but apparently my car smells like weed all the time. So getting thrown in the back of police cars and having the dogs come out and just that type of situation. Nothing. I've had some more intense run-ins with the cops, but the one that happened here was like a traffic stop that, have you been smoking in your car? Is there weed in the car? Blah, blah, blah. And like, it's, there's a tone to some of the things they'll say to you. And it's really frustrating. I'm sorry, I'm getting a little worked up. Like, it's really frustrating because ever since Trump won and all the stuff he's done for around immigration law and stuff, and like, I'm a legal citizen. I have my green card. I'm not a citizen, sorry, but I'm legally here. I have a green card and everything. But you have a Supreme Court saying that people going to immigration court don't have to see a judge within a certain amount of time, can be held indefinitely. You know, a cop pull you over for no reason and, you know, fuck your life up for good, throw you in jail for years without the right to see a judge or legal counsel. And like, you know, I have enough friends and that are immigrants, and I have friends that are illegal immigrants, and I've seen families torn apart and people driven to extremes. And you're in a situation where somebody is clearly treating you a certain way because you look a certain way, and you can't do anything about it, because if you act up on it, you're putting your life on the line. So you're in a situation where you're being treated like shit for being a brown person, and really all you can say if you want to go home that night is yes sir, no sir. And you know, it's a scary time to be an immigrant in this country. The police kind of are the ass end of all the racism and xenophobia and bullshit that's been stirred up. And that last interaction I had was, you know, somebody lying about what I was doing and giving me a ticket for something I didn't do, and giving me that y'all ain't from around here treatment, and making a couple comments about the Mexican community, because there's parts of this country where anything south of California is Mexico. And it's just, you know, you can't. It's a lot to swallow having to sit there and take that shit. Just to be a person, just to exist in this country, you have to swallow shit like that right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's scary.
I mean, there's active ethnic cleansing going on in this country right now. And the law enforcement works together to basically make it possible. You've got local cops that are, you know, historically racist as hell, and then a special force, you know, dedicated strictly to being racist as fuck with ICE.
Yeah.
it's fucked up, man. Like, ICE was setting up patrols outside of schools in my neighborhood to intercept parents and their kids and just fucking haul them off to whatever concentration camp that they've got set up outside of town.
I mean, like, the horror stories you read these days, like, the father, the Honduran father who killed himself in detention after being separated from his son, you know, that one kid, I think he was in Denver, who was actually a dreamer, but he had, like, a drug misdemeanor and a couple traffic tickets. So they send him back to Mexico, and he was murdered 3 weeks later.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
This is the, you know, it's, like, I try, it's hard to explain to people, like, even me as a legal resident who, you know, I'm lucky to own a home and have a job, and I'm not in a shit situation where I pushed or around criminality. But like, seeing that shit day in and day out, like having America kind of tell you like, fuck you, you're less than us, you're not, like, we're allowing you to be here but you're less than us, then that, you hear that in like conservative rhetoric, and they, you know, and like, it, to me, it's a thing where I've experienced racism before Trump. I've had my dealings with the immigrant community, and I've helped with that before, and it's not new. It's, you know, it's not Obama, who I thought was a good president. His immigration record was not a lot more compassionate than this. This is something that's been part of America for a long time. It's in the forefront now, but people are like, you know, we're separating children from their parents. Is this who we are? And it's like, yeah, this is who America is. This is who America has been.
Yeah,
this since the beginning.
Yeah, and people need to, like, you know, it's not like, whoa, Trump came in and turned this country. Like, no, Trump came in because a lot of people were there already. A lot of people in law enforcement and government were there already. He just gave them the opportunity to do it, like, publicly. A lot of this thing is just, you know, the way ICE behaves. And, like, you know, I came up fearing immigration services when they weren't called ICE. And kind of like, just that reality is hard to explain to people who don't experience it. Like, existential angst. Like, having your father tell you, like, you shouldn't say that about politicians on Facebook because they could deport you. Like, having to think about what you say publicly, having to think about where you go. Like, you know, do I carry my green card, and then if it gets lost and a cop stops me, I can lose everything? Or do I leave it at home, and then a cop who won't, like, let me go home get it after he stops me, and the same thing happens? Like, living with that kind of shit, having that on you as an immigrant is a lot. It's not something that, like, you get to forget. It's not something that, like, you see a post about immigration issues online and you're like, oh, that's terrible, and then you continue with your day. That shit is with you. And I think, like, and I'm sorry for going off on this, but, like, if I could communicate anything to people that don't experience it, is to please think about what that's like. Existential fear. The kind of shit that, you know, as it's an exaggeration and it's terrible, but as fascist regimes, as Nazism climbed in Europe, and you were a Catholic or a gay person or a Jew, and you were seeing the rhetoric, and you were, like, hoping that it's not going to come to something horrible, like, that shit is happening in this country right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're in the middle of it. And I think that a lot of people, they think to themselves, oh, if I had lived in the 30s mm-hmm. in Germany, this is what I would have done. Well, what you're doing right now is what you would have done back then.
Yeah. For those of us who are in a position of, I guess, privilege is the word, what would you like us to do? Like, how can we help? What can we do?
Well, I think, I mean, I just, you know, it's got to be genuine support, you know, because I don't think everybody can go, if you have it in you to go out there and join immigration rights groups and participate in marches and participate politically, then please do that. If you have any doubt about whether you as a person of privilege should do that, then you don't let that stop you. At the same time, like, a thing that I'm not a huge fan of online is, like, kind of like seeing people in positions of privilege get so into it that they're like co-opting the struggle of certain people.
It's more about them than the struggle.
Exactly. We're like, I can't speak for black people. I can't speak for, you know, the gay, queer, trans community. I can't speak for them. But just if you're going to get way into it or whatever, be mindful that, like, that's not your reality. Like, you're not the guy who might get deported. You're not the guy getting stopped by the cops for looking the way you do. So don't co-opt that just to, like, kind of make it part of whatever narrative you have about how good a person you think you are. And yeah, my just support and at least like understand it, you know, like just know that there are people in this country who are here legally who are scared shitless to deal with any kind of government because of the reality we live in. That they're, you know, just know that like this country as a country is making people feel scared and less than, and just, you know, whatever knowing that makes moves you to do, I think is the right thing to do.
I'd say that for white dudes especially, there is an opportunity for you to be a useful activist, and that you're less likely to befall any kind of harm for your activism. Like all throughout the South, I've been reading that cops are assassinating black activists who are out doing work against police brutality. You know, it's if you're a member of this marginalized community, there is a very real danger, like you said, as existential danger that as a white dude you really do not face.
Yeah, and like that's a position from where you can do a lot of things. And like, you know, I don't know if I'm as left wing as I used to be. Maybe I am, maybe I'm not. I've never been an anarchist. But there's a narrative about like, don't participate in the system. Like when you participate, like you're kind of acknowledging it. And it's the thing where like that argument, I don't think is being had by people who, if say we had elected Hillary, would still be in the country. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's the thing where like, don't vote for, you know, one of the lesser evils, like, you know, maintain whatever moral high ground you have. And it's like, yeah, but there are people who need food stamps, and there are people who need legal aid in the immigration system, and there are people who need rational immigration law. And the way things are, the only way you're going to affect that is voting for people who aren't crazy assholes. And I catch a lot of flack for that from some of my more ideologically inclined friends and shit. But like, when it's a practical thing, am I going to lose the help that's helping me feed my child? Am I going to, you know, lose protection from law enforcement as a human being? Like, you're not voting, you know, your principles, you're voting your life. And I think for people who aren't part of marginalized groups, sometimes kind of get caught up in that, like, there has to be a revolution. And, oh, I can't wait for Marxism to come back and all this shit. And it's like, that's fine and great. But while you're refusing to vote, more Republicans are getting elected and they're passing horrible laws restricting women, screwing poor people, screwing minorities. So it's, I don't know. Sometimes, like, I just don't know, like, why people can't. If the one sacrifice you have to make is that you're no longer ideologically pure, but you're helping people who need it, like, why not do it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with you at all there. I think, and not to relitigate, you know, the fucking election a million times, I think that what happened there is basically a result of a fundamentally broken democracy. And that the vast majority of people didn't vote for a huge number of reasons, one of which is we make it incredibly difficult for people to vote to begin with.
Yeah. It's just a thing, like, you know, like back home in Colombia, like I grew up kind of like in the shit of like kind of the peaking of two things, which was like the drug trafficking and the cartel wars and stuff, and then the left-wing guerrillas kind of
FARC, is that what it was?
Yeah, the FARC, the LN, DM19. There was a few.
I've seen Narcos.
Oh, so you know.
I was there.
But, you know, in my country, people were murdered for trying to vote, and they still tried to vote. You know, like, people wanted change so badly and were so desperate in the situation that they risked their lives to vote. I think, and I cut Americans a bit of a break on this, because if you're comfortable, you know, if you're a guy who has, like, a fairly decent job, and with that fairly decent job, you can have an apartment and have a hobby and, you know, a normal, calm life, the urgency to fucking affect change or maintain things that need to be maintained, it's harder to put that across. It's really, I think a lot of what happened, you know, and again, I'm with you, like, that whole argument about the Trump election, but I think a lot of it was just people who are like, I'm fine and I'm gonna be fine. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, I have my job, I have my problems, I have my normal day-to-day life and shit. And a lot of people were just like, it doesn't matter. It's just, we're gonna be fine. And that's a very uniquely, probably, you know, I don't wanna, I hate the term, but first world mentality. Like, I can't, you know, one of my first political memories was the candidate for the Liberal Party of in Colombia for president being murdered on television. Like, the stakes of it, the reality of it, the kind of drama of, like, this is urgent that things change. Being growing up in a society where everything, and especially if you grew up like post 9/11 almost, like, where maybe you were a kid when it happened and shit or whatever, but, like, things have been fine and there's no, you know, yeah, like, the Republicans and the Democrats are arguing about blah, blah, blah. And the urgency, I don't think, is there. And I think one of the problems with the left in this country was that they didn't make that case when it's like, this is important and it's important to your community, even if it's not that important to you. And it's not something that, not a message that they were really great at getting across.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. You know, just speaking of political violence, if you would have told me a couple of years ago that Donald Trump would be president right now, I would tell you that I would be shocked that he hasn't been murked yet.
Yeah.
So every day I'm a little surprised by that, that, you know, you don't wake up with news like Trump murked on television.
I'm more surprised he hasn't died on the toilet.
Either one, really.
Yeah, I'm with Jordan. I'm like, you know, he doesn't, I don't know, he doesn't look to me like a guy who should or could live that long. He seems really stressed out all the time about Twitter.
He's mad as fuck online.
Yeah.
He's too miserable to die.
That's the other thing. Like, he's getting so much of what he wants, and he's so mad and petty and, like, vengeful. And it's like, what? Why? Like, we have a guy at the EPA who gives no shits about the environment.
Yeah, man, I hope that guy dies. Like, just straight up. Oh. I hope, if you're listening out here and you want to murk him, like, I'll give you free CDs.
I'll throw in like a 20 spot on that. Yeah, like, there's people like who are out there like on his behalf, like Pruitt and Davos, Devos, whatever
Betsy Davos.
Betsy Davis, like, these are people who are actively destroying good things that America had managed to put together. And it's like, in, you know, I have no intention of killing any of these people, but when they die, I'm going to be really happy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's, I've got bottles of champagne saved for a couple of people when they die. I've got one for Kissinger. I've got one for Pat Robertson, and I'm gonna get a whole bunch for every member of this administration.
Yeah. And like, it's just like the number of people who are like, it's such a fucking comic book darkest timeline thing. Like, yeah, we're gonna make the fucking an oil industry shill, he's going to be in charge of the environment. You know, like, a lady who wants to destroy public education, she's going to be charged with public education. like, I remember there was an episode of Captain Planet where they had like the reverse planeteers, and they had powers like smog and oil and shit. And it's like, really, the reverse planeteers are fucking running the country.
Yeah. No, it's a fucking fire sale. Everything must go. Unfortunately, the items for sale are like everything that our liberal democracy has built up over 100 years. So, sucks to be everyone, I guess. That's going to fuck everybody.
It's interesting to see, man, because like, it's also the thing where like, it's hard to be like, was this how people felt under Reagan and Nixon, that like everything was just going to boom and then it came out on the other end? Or are we truly like on the downslope now?
I think we're at the one of those bad stages of the Roman Empire where
yeah, Pax Americana is coming to an end.
That's
entirely possible. It's gonna be an interesting next few decades though.
Thank
God we have wrestling and music to get through it.
You gotta take the pleasure where you can get it, because it's tough times out there, man. So we are so lucky to have an escape like heavy metal.
Absolutely. Like, yeah, without music, that's just, wow. Yeah, sometimes, some days, you know what? It's made me really appreciate what music has meant in my life, and like the people I've met through it, the pleasure I get out of it, like the whole lifestyle. My life revolves around music with the label and everything. And just, I can't imagine when I meet people who are like, yeah, you know, I like music. I have like, you know, some shit downloaded. And like, what's your favorite band? I don't have one. I listen to everything. Like, those people to me are the most alien thing in the universe. Like, how do you not have favorite bands? And also, how do you not have bands that you absolutely hate and want to see like destroyed?
Yeah, man. I listen to everything except country, metal, and rap. That's my favorite kind of person.
Yeah, there's when I was single, there was a lot of that in OK Cupid.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Just like a lot of I don't listen to poor people music.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's shorthand for like, I don't like working class music.
I don't want to hear about people's problems that don't match my privileged existence. Maybe we're reading into it, but I don't think we are.
No, absolutely not. I've gotten in this conversation with so many people. They're like, rap, country music, metal, these are all, you know, historically working class or poverty made music.
And it's also like music for like people that acknowledge there's shit going on.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And the other one, the like, oh, I love everything, that to me is shorthand for like, oh, you don't care about music.
Have you ever met a person though, like, because I had a former roommate, and to this day it still weirds me out, he just didn't like music. Like, not into it. Not my thing.
Yes. And like, I don't know, like, how do you exist? How do you, what's your internal monologue like when, and to me, like, also, it's just kind of like with art, you know, like, if you don't have like movies or comic books or that you're passionate about or music that you're passionate about, like, what the fuck do you do? What do you care about? Why?
I don't know, man. I don't know.
You know, I wonder if there's like somewhere there's like a podcast of three dudes who like just into like, I don't know, sports and cars. And I'm into cars and like sports a little bit, but just like dudes who are like, I don't get these dudes who are like way into music and that's their whole thing.
This is probably more common than you think. I don't want to associate with those people, all right? Those people.
Yeah. That's what those people mean to me. Like, you don't have a passion for anything that people create. Yeah, sorry, no.
Is there anything that you'd like to plug on here before we call it?
Yeah, like there's the last release on the label, the Aureole of Ash record, which I'm really really proud to be a part of. Great. Political grind from Germany, people who are in Resurrectionists and Republic of Dreams. That's out now. It's doing well on the downloads and stuff. I have the CDs if anybody's interested. I think it's a record that really deserves to be out there. So if anybody wants to check out absolute Contempt on Bandcamp. We have all the stuff on there. A lot of the stuff is set to pay what you want downloads, and all that money goes to cat rescues and rescues in Peru and Egypt and Syria and the U.S.
Hell yeah. Get some grind. Save the kitties. We're going to play a track from Oriole of Ash, too. We covered that on Toilet Tuesday the other day, and we'll give it another listen here. Well, I wanted to thank you, Daniel, for coming on and talking with us today. I think throughout the last hour, we've certainly given people a lot to think about. Number one, starting a label, maybe not super profitable, but if you print luchador masks, you'll do real well.
And that should go without saying, I
absolutely
think.
What are the websites for you and for any of the animal stuff that you work with?
For the animal rescues, you can check out the Misfit Critter Farm in Virginia. They're a great rescue organization. If you look for the Catman of Aleppo, it's a guy who rescues animals in Syria during the war. He's somebody that I've been giving to. If you Cat's Garden Shelter in Peru, it's another rescue that I've worked with. The greatest cat house in the world in Florida. God, I'm forgetting a couple, but yeah. Seal Rescue in Ireland, who rescue abandoned or orphaned seal pups that wash up there. I've given to a couple dozen different rescues. I'm a big advocate of people volunteering, and if you can't volunteer, give money to your local animal rescue. Especially, you know, right now we're in the kind of post kitten season time for cat rescues, and they really need the money and the help. So if any of the ones I mentioned don't float your boat, find something locally. There's always a humane society around that needs help or money.
All right, go give to those organizations. And thanks so much for doing the show, Daniel.
No problem, guys. It was a pleasure.
All right, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.